He knew he had already lost half of them. Another quarter at the very least would perish before he could reach Zanzibar. Many more would go even after they were landed. Only the very hardiest would be fit for the market, and then only after careful convalescence. Another indication of his losses, though not as accurate, was the smell. Some of them must have gone on the very first day of the calm, and without the wind the heat had been blinding. It would be even worse in the holds. The corpses would be swollen to twice life size. The smell was bad. He could not recall a worse stench in all his 40 years. It was a pity that there was no way in which to remove the bodies, but this could only be done in port. Sheikh Yusuf dealt only in young females. They were smaller and much hardier than males of the same age, and could be loaded more densely. He had been able to reduce the clearance between each deck by 6 inches, which meant an entire extra deck could be built into the hold. Females had a remarkable ability to go without water for longer periods than males. Like the camel of the desert, they seemed able to exist on the accumulated fat in their thighs, buttocks, and bosoms, and to make the Mozambique passage, even in the fairest conditions of wind and tide, required 5 days without water. Another consideration was the loss of males destined for China and the Far East by the necessary surgery. The Chinese buyers insisted that all male slaves be castrated before they would purchase. It was a logical precaution to prevent breeding with the local population, but one that entailed additional losses to the trader who must perform the operation. The final reason that Sheikh Yusuf dealt only in comely young females was that they commanded a price almost twice that of a young male slave in the Zanzibar market. Before Sheikh Yusuf loaded his wares, he allowed them to fatten for at least a week in his barracoons, with as much to eat and drink as they could force down their throats. Then they were stripped naked, except for light chains, and at low tide taken out to the dhow where it lay high and dry on the shoaling beach. The first girls aboard were made to lie on the bare boards of the hull in the bottom of the hold, each on her left side with her knees raised slightly, so that the knees of the girl behind her could fit against the back of her legs, the front of her pelvis against buttocks, belly against back, like a row of spoons in a rack. At intervals the chains were snapped into the ring bolts already set into the deck. This was not only for security, but also to prevent the layer of human bodies sliding about in rough weather, piling up in heaps and crushing those beneath. Once the bottom of the hold was covered with a layer of humanity, the next deck was placed in position over them, so close that they could not attempt to sit upright or even roll over. The next layer of girls was laid over them, and the next deck over them again. To reach the lower decks meant laboriously unchaining and unloading each layer of humanity, and lifting the intervening decks. It could not even be attempted at sea. However, with the trade wind standing fair, it was a straight run down the channel, and the wind blowing in through the canvas scoops and ports kept the air below decks breathable and the heat bearable. Sheikh Yusuf sighed again and lifted his roomy eyes to the unbroken blue line of the eastern horizon. "This will be my last voyage," he decided, whispering aloud in the way of old men. "Allah has been good, and I am a rich man with many strong sons. Perhaps this is his sign to me. This will indeed be my last voyage." It was almost as though he had been overheard, for the scarlet banner moved lazily like an adder emerging from long hibernation, then slowly reared its head, and Sheikh Yusuf felt the wind on his seared and wrinkled cheek. He stood up suddenly, quick and supple as a man half his age, and stamped his bare foot on the deck. "Up!" he cried. "Up, my children! Here is the wind at last." And while his crew scrambled to their feet, he took the long tiller under his arm and threw back his head to watch the sail bulge outwards and the thick, clumsy pole of the mast heel slowly across a horizon suddenly dark with the scurry of the trade wind. Clinton Codrington caught the first whiff of it during the night. It woke him from a nightmare that he had lived through on many other nights. and when he lay sweating in his narrow wooden bunk, the smell persisted, and he threw a boat cloak over his bare shoulders and hurried up on deck. It came in gusts out of the darkness. For minutes at a time, the warm, sweet rush of the trade wind brought only the iodine and salt smell of the sea. Then suddenly there was another curdled whiff of it. It was a smell that Clinton would never forget, like the smell of a cage full of carnivorous beasts that had never been cleaned, the stench of excrement and rotten flesh, and his nightmare came rushing back upon him in full strength. 10 years before, when Clinton had been a very junior midshipman aboard the old Widgeon, one of the very first gunboats of the anti-slavery squadron, they had taken a slaver in northern latitudes. She was a schooner of 300 tons burden out of Lisbon, but flying a Brazilian flag of convenience, with the unlikely name of Hirondelle Blanche, the White Swallow. Clinton had been ordered into her, as prize master with orders to run her into the nearest Portuguese port and deliver her to the courts of mixed commission to be condemned as a prize. They had made the capture 100 nautical miles off the Brazilian coast after the Hirondelle Blanche and her 500 black slaves had almost completed the dreaded Middle Passage. Under orders, Clinton had turned the schooner and sailed her back to the Cape Verde Islands, crossing the equator to do so, and lying 3 days becalmed in the doldrums before breaking from their suffocating grip. In the harbour of Praia, on the principal island of São Tiago, Clinton had been refused permission to land any of his slaves, and they had lain 16 days waiting for the Portuguese president of the Court of Mixed Commission to reach a decision. Finally, the president had decided, after strenuous representation by the owners of the Hirondelle Blanche, that he had no jurisdiction in the case, and ordered Clinton to sail her back to Brazil and submit the vessel to the Brazilian courts. However, Clinton knew very well what a Brazilian court would decide, and instead set a course for the British naval station on St. Helena Island, once more crossing the equator with his burden of human misery. By the time he dropped anchor in Jamestown Roads, the surviving slaves aboard had made 3 consecutive crossings of the terrible Middle Passage. There were only 26 of them still alive, and the smell of a slaver had become part of the nightmares which still plagued Clinton 10 years later. Now he stood on the darkened deck and flared his nostrils, the same smell coming to him out of the tropical night, horrible and unmistakable. He had to drag himself away with a physical effort to give the orders to fire Black Joke's furnace and work up a head of steam in her boilers, ready for the dawn. Sheikh Yusuf recognized the dark shape with a sense of utter disbelief and the dismay of one finally deserted by Allah. She was still 5 miles distant, indistinct in the dusty pink light of the dawn, but coming up swiftly, a thick column of black smoke smearing away on her beam, carried low over the green waters of the inshore channel by the boisterous trade wind. The same wind spread out her ensign to full view from the poop of the dhow, and in the field of Sheikh Yusuf's ancient brass and leather-bound telescope, it snapped and flickered, the snowy white field crossed by bold bright scarlet. How he hated that flag! The symbol of an arrogant, bullying people, tyrants of the oceans, captors of continents. He had seen gunboats like this one in Aden and Calcutta. He had seen that same flag flying in every far corner of every sea he had ever sailed. Very clearly he knew what it all meant. He put up the helm in that gesture acknowledging the final end to a disastrous voyage. The dhow came around reluctantly, creaking in every timber, the great sail flogging before it could be trimmed to take the wind over the stern. There had seemed to be so little risk, he thought with weary resignation. Of course, the treaty that the Sultan had made with the Zanzibar consul of these dangerous infidels allowed his subjects to trade in the black pearls between any of the Sultan's possessions, with the proviso that only Omani Arabs loyal to the Sultan could indulge in the lucrative traffic. No person of Christian European extraction, not even a converted Muslim, could sail under the Sultan's flag. And not even an Omani Arab might trade beyond the borders of the Sultan's possessions. The Sultan's African possessions had been very carefully defined in the treaty, and here was he, Sheikh Yusuf, with a cargo of 330 living, dying, and dead slaves, at least 150 miles south of the furthest of the Sultan's borders, with a British gunboat bearing down upon him. Truly the ways of Allah were wonderful, passing the comprehension of man, Sheikh Yusuf thought, with only the slightest taste of bitterness in his throat, as he hung grimly onto the tiller and made his run for the land. A gun thumped from the gunboat's bows. Powder smoke flew bright as a seabird's wing in the first rays of the low sun, and Sheikh Yusuf spat passionately over the lee bulwark and said aloud, "El Shitan, the devil," using for the first time the name with which in time Captain Clinton Codrington would be known throughout the length of the Mozambique Channel and as far north as the Great Horn of Africa. The bronze screw under Black Joke's counter thrashed out a long, wide wake behind her. She still had main and jib set, but Codrington would shorten to fighting sail just as soon as he had made the adjustment to counter the dhow's turn away towards the land. Zuga and Robin were on the quarterdeck to watch the chase, infected by the restrained businesslike excitement which gripped the vessel, so that Zuga laughed aloud and called, "Gone away, tally-ho!" as the dhow turned, and Clinton glanced at him with a conspiratory grin. "She's a slaver. Apart from the stink, that turn-away proves it beyond doubt." Robin strained forward to watch the filthy little vessel, with its discoloured and patched sail, the unpainted timbers of the hull striped with zebra stripes of human excrement and other wastes. It was her first view of a slaver actually carrying on its grisly trade, and she felt herself filled with a new purpose. She had come so far for this moment, and she tried to capture every detail of it for her journal. "Mr. Denham, give him a gun, if you please," ordered Clinton. The bow chaser thudded, but the dhow held to her new course. "Be ready to round up and send the boat away on the instant." Clinton's excitement had given way to obvious anxiety. He turned to look across at his boarding party. They had been issued with cutlass and pistol, and waited now in the waist under the command of a young ensign. Clinton would dearly have liked to command the boarding party himself, but his arm was still in its sling, and the stitches still in the wound. To go aboard a dhow in a rough sea and fight its crew required both hands, and the agility which his wound denied him. Reluctantly, he had put Ferris in charge of the boarders. Now he looked back at the dhow, and his expression was grim. "He's going to beach." They were all silent now, staring ahead, watching the slaver run in towards the land. "But there is a coral reef," Robin spoke for them all, pointing to the black points that broke the surface a quarter of a mile short of the land itself. They looked like a necklace of shark's teeth, and the surf broke and swirled about them as it was driven in upon the trade wind. "Yes," Clinton agreed. "They will run it up on the coral and escape across the lagoon." "But what about the slaves?" Robin asked, horrified. And nobody answered her. Black Joke rushed on purposefully. But with the wind almost dead astern, the dhow trained her long boom around to go on to her best point of sailing. The boom was longer than the hull itself, and the huge triangular mainsail bulged far out, almost touching the surface of the water, as she hurled down upon the reef. "We may just cut her off," Zuga said loudly. But he did not have the seaman's eye for bearing and speed, and Clinton Codrington shook his head angrily. "Not this time." But it was very finely run. Clinton held his course up until the very last moment, and the dhow passed a mere 200 yards ahead of her bows, so close that he could clearly make out the features of the helmsman on the vessel's poop deck, a skinny old Arab in long flowing robe and with the tasselled fez on his head that declared that he had made the pilgrimage to Mecca. On his belt glittered the gold filigree hilt of the short curved dagger of a sheikh, and his long, scraggling white beard fluttered in the wind as he leaned on the long tiller and turned his head to watch the high black hull bearing down on him.